Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out what strength I need to be able to see you guys at least a little bit in my notes. Well, today we are going to continue our study of the book of Joshua. We'll be looking today at chapter 7, verses 1 through 26. I actually put off teaching the book of Joshua for about 10 years till Jeff talked me into doing it at Starbucks one time, not long ago, because it's a very difficult book. It has some parts of the book which, quite frankly, disturb a lot of people. And I guess I didn't want to sit up here and have to answer all the questions that were going to come up here. But here we are in the midst of the book of Joshua. So my thinking is this: instead of trying to deal with the difficulties of this book all at once, periodically as we go through the book, I'm going to take a few minutes, either up front or at some point in the lesson, to try to address some of the difficulties that are in this book, primarily associated with the amount of violence that we see there. So as I start this morning, and a lot of what I'm going to say in the opening section of this lesson is summarized at the end of the handout, but I have a word that I want to say today about the conquest that we're studying, the book of Joshua versus Islamic Jihad. In the 1990s, I spent a great deal of time in Manhattan. I know for a fact that in 1995, I was there for 4 months, so this was not just a periodic trip or two to New York. For several years, I had a meeting in Midtown every other Monday at 1:30 p.m. So my alarm would go off at 4:30 in Plano, and I would get up and head out to DFW and return home usually on Friday night or Saturday morning. I had a lot of customers in the World Trade Center, and one of the favorite places that I would go for business meetings was Windows on the World, which is on the top floor of the North Tower. Often during those years, because time with Linda was challenged by my schedule, she would fly up on the weekends and she'd spend New York, the weekend in New York with me, particularly if I were going to have to go back the next Monday. So we, over the period of time, made quite a few friends up there, some of my colleagues at work. And one of our particularly good friends, a woman I worked with, and we became friends with her and her husband, not surprisingly, being from New York, she held different political and religious views from mine. But believe it or not, there was actually a time in this country when people could disagree about things like that and not hate each other. I know that's hard to believe, but those times actually existed. It's amazing. Not long after the attack on the World Trade Center, in fact, I think Linda and I were on the first flight to New York after ATC reopened the airspace. I know that the Trade Center was still smoking when we walked down there. Anyway, we met up with our friends for a somber walk down to the site. We stood there in stark amazement at what we saw. I was back in New York the next week, and I had dinner with some friends and colleagues from the office. And, of course, the World Trade Center attack was the topic of conversation, as it always was during that time in New York City. One of the men, whose name was Jan, and who knew I was from Texas — by the way, I should tell you this, I am naturally suspicious of any guy who goes by the name Jan. It's just, just so you know, it's just one of those things.
Is that in the gospel?
No, not that, no. In any case, he asked me what I thought the motive for the attack was. And so I think back on that question, I think I answered him by quoting something from Surah 9 of the Quran. But whatever I said, it set off the New Yorkers, who immediately said something to the effect of, "Well, you can't quote the Quran in the context of the World Trade Center attack without also pointing out that the Bible is no different from the Quran. After all, the Jews, think conquest, the book of Joshua, and Christians, think crusades, are no different from the jihadists. The Bible is just as full of violence as the Quran. Now, for the record, I was the only person in the conversation who had actually read every word of the Bible and every word of the Quran. In fact, I was probably the only person there who had ever touched either one of those books physically. By the way, the objection that I heard that day is the view of many academics, many theologians, and probably a lot of people in the population of our country, primarily because the mainstream media has picked up that narrative and they push it at every opportunity. But the question is this, is this an accurate assessment of the Bible? Excuse me. Is it an accurate assessment of the Quran? To answer this question, we need to look not just at similarities that might exist there, but differences. Differences in what is called jihad and what we see in the conquest in the book of Joshua. To start, I'm going to make a point. The Quran calls for unrestricted territorial expansion. The Quran calls for unrestricted territorial expansion. And between the 7th and 13th centuries, Islam experienced the greatest geographical expansion as a consequence of warfare against non-Muslims, from Spain to India to Africa, and of course it included the Middle East. The second point is this. There are fundamental differences between the battles recorded in the book of Joshua and elsewhere in the Old Testament and those that have occurred over time throughout Islamic history. The battles of the conquest were limited. They were limited in time frame, in scope, and in geography, whereas the battles waged by the jihadists were unlimited in time frame, scope, and geography. And third, and this may be the most important point, there is an important principle of interpretation that we need to keep in mind when we read the book of Joshua. The biblical narratives are mostly descriptive. They are not prescriptive. What I mean by that is the Bible records what occurred, for example, at Jericho, but it does not necessarily prescribe those same actions for all peoples in every era. Said another way, not all non-Israelites were considered enemies of Israel, and Israel didn't attack all non-Israelites just because they didn't worship Yahweh. The fact that God did use Israel as his instrument of judgment against the Canaanites, as, by the way, was foretold in Genesis chapter 15, 14 through 16, it did not prescribe this same action against all other Gentile communities. Look sometime at Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 16. For example, Israel was prohibited from displacing the Edomites or the Moabites from their lands in Transjordan. Again, Deuteronomy chapter 2. But these peoples, the Moabites and the Edomites, would not have been spared under Islamic doctrine. The Quran, on the other hand, is almost universally prescriptive. What it prescribes in its pages applies across the board to Muslims in every age and in every location. There's a reason there is a non-prescriptive slant to the Bible's understanding of war, while the opposite is true for Islam. And the difference lies in the actual substance of the two systems. To grasp this difference, it's helpful to understand how Islam looks at the world. In Islamic thought, the world is divided into two houses. The first is Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam. The second is Dar al-Harb, the house of war. And this includes Jews, Christians, infidels, all non-Muslims. Where these two houses intersect, you might guess there's a clash of civilizations. Where they clash is a friction point, and that's where jihad occurs, where these two cultures come together. It's the mission of the House of Islam to convert all who are in the house of war to the Islamic faith, whether by word or by sword. It's also interesting to understand how they define peace. Peace is defined as the time when the house of war ceases to exist. That would be you. When the house of war ceases to exist and the entire world is under Islamic rule, when Sharia law is the law not of the land, but of the world. Classic Islam requires Muslims to subject all nations to Muslim rule under Sharia. So its mission is global in nature. When you hear the term caliphate tossed around, this is a religio-political society, our community, that is global in nature, where all the people of the world are governed both in terms of religion and politics, and that's an important thing to understand, by the tenets of the Quran and Sharia law. Caliphate recognizes no national boundaries, and it is universal in purpose. And since there's no time frame laid out for the creation of this universal Islamic state, the prescriptive nature of jihad extends to all Muslims in all time periods. And in stark contrast, Israel's conquest of Canaan was a limited military action, both in terms of geography and time frame, and its purpose was never world domination, but the establishment of a homeland for the descendants of Abraham. During the late Bronze Age, when the book of Joshua takes place, Canaan was in a constant state of war, not necessarily with Israel, but the indigenous tribes in Canaan were at war with each other. Now, the conquest was brutal, but at the end of the day, the purpose of the conquest was stabilization. It was never perpetual war. Israel didn't continue to wage war against towns once the threat of the population center was neutralized. And when considered theologically, we can't fail to recognize that God was doing two things at once during the conquest. First, he was fulfilling his covenant to Abraham with respect to the land promise. And second, he was bringing judgment on the Canaanites, who were markedly evil. Check out Leviticus 18, Genesis 15, particularly verse 16. They were so evil, in fact, that God's judgment required the total dissolution and destruction of their culture. And it's important to note that the judgment God brought on the Canaanites was because of their egregious moral failings, not because they were non-Israelites. That's a huge difference in the conquest and what was happening in the book of Joshua and Islamic expansion through jihad. At some point, not today, I'm going to spend some time talking about the explicit nature of the evil of the Canaanites. And I think when we go through that process, you're going to see why God's judgment was necessary and inevitable. So with that in mind, let's now turn to chapter 7. Chapter 7 is easily divided into two parts. The first 15 verses give the account of the sin of Achan, a man named Achan. And in verses 16 through 26, the second section, it describes the consequences of the sin of Achan. And I think it's helpful if you understand that this first section looks at the sin of Achan primarily from a human perspective, while in the second half of the chapter, it looks at Achan's sins primarily from a divine perspective. And that will help us interpret these two sections of the Bible. So we're going to begin today by looking at the first section, chapter 7, verses 1 through 15. And again, this is looking at Achan's sin primarily from a human perspective. But the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. Therefore, the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. Now Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth Aven, east of Bethel, and he sent them and said, "Go up and spy out the land." So the men went up and they spied it out. And they returned to Joshua, said to him, "Don't let all the people go up. Only 2,000 or 3,000 men need go up to Ai. Don't make the people go up there because there aren't very many people there." So about 3,000 men from Israel went up there, but they fled from the men to Ai. The men of Ai struck down about 36 of their men and pursued them from the gate as far as Shevarim and struck them down on the descent so that the hearts of the people, that is the Israeli people, melted and became as water. Then Joshua tore his clothes and he fell to the earth on his face before the Ark of the Covenant and cast dust on his head, he and the elders of Israel. Joshua said, "Alas, O Lord God, why did you ever bring your people across the Jordan only to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites and to destroy us? If only we had been willing to dwell beyond the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say since Israel has turned their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear it, and they will surround us, and they will cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name?" So the Lord said to Joshua, "Rise up. Why is it that you've fallen on your face? Israel has sinned, and they also have transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them, and they have taken some of the things under the ban and have both stolen and deceived. Moreover, they have also put them among their own things. Therefore, the sons of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. They've turned their backs before their enemies, for they have become accursed. I will not be with you anymore unless you destroy the things under the ban in your midst. Rise up, consecrate the people, and say, 'Consecrate yourselves for tomorrow. For thus the Lord God of Israel has said, there are things under the ban in your midst. O Israel, you cannot stand before your enemies until you have removed the things under the ban from your midst. In the morning, then, you shall come near by your tribes, and it shall be that the tribe which the Lord takes by lot shall come near by families, and the family which the Lord takes shall come by household, and the household which the Lord takes shall come man by man. It shall be that the one who is taken with the things under the ban shall be burned with fire, he and all that belongs to him, because he has transgressed the covenant of the Lord and because he has committed a disgraceful thing in Israel." So, this section is looking again at Achan's sin from a pretty much a human perspective. For a clear understanding of what's happening in verse 1 here, we need to look back at the previous chapter, verse 17 through 19, because that's where we learn about this ban that was mentioned in chapter 7. So in chapter 6, 17, God says, he's speaking here of Jericho, "The city shall be under a ban, it and all that belongs to the Lord, only Rahab the harlot, and those who are with her in the house shall live because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, keep yourselves from the things under the ban so that you do not covet them, and take some of the things under the ban and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze that are in the holy are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So our story centers around a military defeat that took place near a little village called Ai. Now, you're going to hear that word pronounced differently here and there, but in Hebrew it can only be pronounced one way, and that's Ai, because it's a one-syllable word. Ai was a village that was located about 15 miles west-northwest of Jericho and about 12 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And it was nowhere near as fortified as Jericho. The population was smaller, and all indications were that Ai would be a pushover for the Israelite army. After all, look what happened in Jericho. But things didn't go as planned. Israel fled in retreat from the men of Ai, and about 36 of their soldiers were killed. Now, I'm sure you recall that there's been a strategic advantage that has worked to the favor of Israel from the beginning of the conquest. And that strategic advantage has to do with the fear that the Canaanites felt for Israel, which paralyzed the fighting men of Jericho so that they could not fight. And I pointed out previously that God had prepared the Israelites for victory through reinstitution of Passover and circumcision, but that God had prepared the Canaanites for defeat by means of their fear of Israel. But this strategic advantage is now gone. And that's a bigger deal, quite frankly, than the 36 dead Israeli soldiers. Listen to what again to what Joshua says in verses 8 and 9. He says, he points this out. He says, what can I say since Israel has turned their back on the enemy? The Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear it and they'll surround us and cut off our name from the earth. He knows this is a serious turn of events. Notice the way the Israelites are described in verse 5. They're described as people whose hearts have melted and become like water. This sounds exactly like how Rahab described the men of Jericho in chapter 2. She said, when we heard what the Lord did to you through you to the Amorite coalition, our hearts melted away, and no courage remained in any man because of you. But at Ai, Israel has become like the Canaanites, lacking confidence and terrified. So Joshua understood the significance of this loss of Israel's strategic advantage. Namely, the Canaanites had believed previously that the Israelites could not be defeated, and now that's been proven to be untrue. The advantage now is gone because Israel fled from the men of Ai. But if you think about it, the advantage never lay with the Israelite army anyway. The only advantage they ever had was God's promise to fight for Israel, and that was dependent upon Israel's obedience to the covenant, for it was on the basis of the covenant that God promised the land to Israel. At this point in the story, Joshua doesn't know about Achan's sin. So when we're reading through this, we know something he doesn't know. The only thing Joshua knows is the defeat. He doesn't understand why it occurred, and he reacts by tearing his clothing, casting dust on his head, and falling to the ground before the Ark of the Covenant. The great leader Joshua is now in a case or in a state of despair that's so severe that in a very real sense, he has to be questioning his own faith. And it's interesting that he expresses his doubts in a little short prayer. He says, why, O Lord, did you bring your people across the Jordan only to have us fall in defeat before the enemy? And how can you allow your own name to be defamed among the Amorites? Well, what can we learn from this little prayer? I think maybe we learned that it's better to pray imperfectly sometimes, even if the prayer expresses doubts of our own faith, than not to pray at all. And this is what Joshua does. He lays his doubts before the Lord, and the Lord then tells Joshua something he did not know previously. Namely, there is sin in the camp of Israel. The defeat took place at Ai, but the issue that led to the defeat goes back to Jericho, and Joshua tells us about it in verse 1. If I were to translate the Hebrew text of verse 1 literally, word for word, here's how it would begin. But they acted unfaithfully, the sons of Israel, unfaithfully with regard to the ban. They acted unfaithfully is in the emphatic position in the Hebrew sentence. In other words, it's actually one word at the beginning of the sentence. And that, when a word is in the emphatic position, it adds emphasis to the severity here of Israel's sin. And then, unlike in the English text, the word unfaithfully is repeated again. So there's a very strong stress on Israel acting unfaithfully. I think what it means to act unfaithfully here means to act undercover. In other words, Achan thought he could disobey the commandment of the Lord and get away with it. On the day the walls of Jericho fell, God put that city under a ban. The Hebrew word for ban is harem. The word harem is actually an Arabic word that means to prohibit. It sounds like, and in fact is exactly the same word as our word harem. And it means that the women of a harem are off limits to anyone but the king or the sultan or whatever the appropriate title is for the person who possesses the harem. So if you ever wonder what the word ban is, it's harem. It has an Ethiopic cognate that adds the idea of something that is under a curse. So the word means something that is excluded, an object that is excluded from common use. And in this sense, the object is then considered to be devoted to God. And this is how this word is used in our sentence. Notice the sin was committed by one man, but the consequences of it fell on the entire camp of Israel. That ought to sound familiar to you. How can the sin of one man fall on a group? That's another lesson. In verse 1, the text says, the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully. And then in verse 11, it says, Israel have sinned and they, plural, have transgressed. And then in verse 12, we see the result of this disobedience. The sons of Israel, again, plural, cannot stand before their enemies. So a couple of questions come up immediately in verse 1. Why is the entire nation held responsible for the sin of one individual? And why, as we'll see in a moment, were Achan's family and his animals executed along with Achan? This is how you get into these problems in the book of Joshua. It's like getting a speeding ticket and having them throw your wife in jail. I mean, it's like, what's going on here? Well, we really shouldn't be surprised, because one of the verses we read in Joshua chapter 6, verse 18, he says, as for you, keep yourselves, plural, from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them, and take some of the things that are under the ban, and make the camp of Israel accursed, and bring trouble on Israel. So God warned them. The answer to this question lies in the uniqueness of living in Israel under the covenant. The covenant relationship united Israel in a way that recognized the individual, but acknowledged a connection linking the people as a group together with their covenant God. In Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, and elsewhere in the Old Testament, Israel is described by the Lord as my son, my firstborn. And this is how the Lord treats Israel, as if Israel, the community of Israel, were his son. A couple of weeks ago, I made an analogy between the unity that Israel shares under the covenant and the unity we share as members of the body of Christ. We see this expressed clearly by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 17, who writes, we who are many are one body. I was careful 2 weeks ago to point out that Israel and the church are different entities in God's plan, but that does not preclude similarities. The church, made up of many believers, is referred to as the bride of Christ, as if we who are many are uniquely bound together and rightfully can be thought of as a unified body. Under the covenant, God treats Israel as a unified body. Israel is his son. When Joshua prohibits Israel from taking anything under the ban, the prohibition is given to the nation. So the consequences of breaking the ban is any violation will result in the whole camp of Israel being accursed. That is all Israel. We see individual responsibility in the execution of Achan, but we see covenant unity in the declaration that Israel sinned, and the consequences of that sin led to the military defeat, which was a defeat experienced by all Israel. Now, the trouble that started with Achan's violation of the ban was exacerbated by the reconnaissance team's conclusion in verse 3 that Ai's going to be a pushover, such that only 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers need to go up against the city. Where in this exchange between the spies and Joshua do we see any indication by anyone that perhaps they should ask God what his plan is for Ai? Where do we see the divine instructions say from Joshua 6:2? Remember that? The Lord said to Joshua, see, I've given Jericho into your hand. Or how about the 8th chapter, verse 1, after all this is going to get straightened out and they're going to have to go back to Ai, we read, do not fear, be dismayed, take all the people of war, not 2,000, all of them with you, and arise and go up to Ai, for I've given into your hand the king of Ai and the people of the city and all of his land. Well, the fact is, we don't see any of that in the beginning of chapter 7. In a matter of a few days, the Israelites came to believe the conquest could be accomplished through their own efforts and through their military expertise. They forgot that it was God who brought down the walls of Jericho. This is human viewpoint, and we're all guilty of it. Divine viewpoint is just the opposite. Divine viewpoint acknowledges, not by might, nor by power, nor by my spirit, but by my spirit, says the Lord God Almighty. So to defeat, the defeated eye was a result of two things. Primarily, Achan's sin regarding the ban, but also Israel's dependence on her own military expertise, which in reality was virtually non-existent. That became, in their minds, the basis for victory over the Canaanites. It was a classic case of overconfidence. Before I learned to fly airplanes in 1979, I was absolutely certain I could land an airplane by myself the first time with zero need of an instructor. I'd read books. I'd thought about this, visualized this process of landing an airplane 1,000 times, and I was sure I could do it perfectly the first time. Well, I learned to fly at Addison Airport, which, of course, has this long, wide, long runway. So on the day my instructor, his name was Mike Billups, by the way, told me that we were going to go practice landings, I thought we would be doing it at Addison, or at least maybe we would go up to Denton or McKinney or someplace with a, you know, big, nice runway. So I was all perfectly ready for this. I was sure I could do it. I was sure I could do it perfectly. I am in the mode here that I'm going to impress Mike Billups. I'm often think back on that day, and I remember the word pride becomes before a fall. Well, we took off at Addison. Mike said, head out toward Denton. So I thought, okay, we're going to Denton. It's got a big runway. No problem. This is going to be fun. Well, about the time we got out over Lake Louisville, Mike said, see that little brown dirt landing strip over on that island? It's called Lakeview. That's where you're going to learn to land an airplane. Lakeview is a little small dirt landing strip about the size of an aircraft carrier. I said, you got to be kidding. He said, nope, if you can learn to land at Lakeview, you'll be able to land any place, including your own backyard if necessary. There are times when self-confidence is a good thing, and there are times when it isn't. I learned that day at Lakeview that I wasn't capable of doing what I was certain I could do. Now, my consequences weren't as severe as what Israel encountered at Ai. 36 Israeli soldiers died there. I only suffered a mild loss of pride. I survived, learned to land an airplane at Lakeview because someone who knew more than I did was sitting a few inches off to the right. But it was a humbling experience. Verse 11 condemns the nation by detailing the nature of the sin. It begins, Israel sinned. The Hebrew word for sin is hatah. And like the verb, acted unfaithfully in verse 1, it's in the emphatic position in verse 11. Hatah can mean to miss the mark, or it can mean to come up short, or it can mean to incur guilt. You may remember the story in Daniel chapter 5 of Belshazzar. The text says he was weighed in the balances and found deficient. In other words, he missed the mark. He came up short. He lacked something. But the Bible declares we've all come up short. There's only one remedy for not meeting the standard God has set for us, which, by the way, is absolute, perfect righteousness. The remedy is the blood of Christ that symbolizes the atoning death on the cross, by which Jesus bore in his own body the guilt and punishment for the sins of the world. The only way a man can meet God's standard, that is, to not come up short, is if God imputes to him the very righteousness of Christ on the basis of faith alone in Christ alone. Absolute righteousness can never be earned. It is a gift. It's a gift of God available to the sinner on the basis of Christ's death on the cross, and there is no other way to attain it than to accept it as a free gift of God paid for in full by the blood of Christ. Well, verse 11 continues, After saying Israel has missed the mark and fallen short of the divine standard, the text goes on to say that Israel has another problem. Israel also has transgressed. Transgression is a legal term that means the transgressor is legally guilty under the law. Do you remember 2 weeks ago I said that the word Hebrew means one who crosses over? I pointed out that ivri, the Hebrew word for Hebrew, comes from a verb, avar, that means to cross over. Well, there's another word that's derived from that same verb, avar, and it's the word transgression. Isn't that interesting? Avar, to cross over. Derivative, Hebrew, derivative, transgression. Interesting, from the same verb. What this means is that Israel not only came up short in the righteousness department, but the people have crossed over a line set by the law and therefore are legally guilty and subject to whatever consequences the law determines is appropriate. In one case, they crossed over the Jordan River and won a great victory at Jericho. Now they've crossed over the line that breaks the covenant. Let's consider what Israel has done, and remember, we have to look at Israel and Achan together because of the unique blending of the individual and the nation under the covenant. As we saw, Israel was warned in chapter 6 not to covet the things that were under the ban. That's the fundamental problem here. God said, do not covet the things that are under the ban, much less take any of them. But I want you to notice something. The prohibition begins with wanting stuff. This is why keeping the law is impossible. Israel was forbidden from wanting anything that was in the city of Jericho because all of it was under the ban. Now, not wanting is real different than not taking. One has to do with your hands, the other has to do with your heart. By analogy, this aspect of the expectation of the Mosaic law is like a person addicted to cigarettes who can, through sheer willpower, stop smoking cigarettes. But no amount of willpower in the world can keep him from wanting a cigarette. And yet, that's the level on which obedience to the law operates. Jesus made this clear in the Sermon on the Mount. And it's the reason no man can be saved through law-keeping. It's impossible. So here's Achan, tempted by shiny things in Jericho. And he did what God said not to do. And in so doing, he broke the 10th commandment, you shall not covet. Then Achan and thus all Israel broke the 8th commandment. You shall not take something that doesn't belong to you. So Israel sinned, also transgressed the law, and as if that were not enough, Israel also acted deceptively. Verses 12 through 14 cite the remedy. The sin problem must be addressed. The banned items must be removed from the camp, and the offender, in this case Achan, must be punished. The process is going to involve calling all the people together by tribes and families and households, and eventually by individuals. The means by which this offender will be identified is through a process of casting lots. So, the next day the people will be awakened probably by the blowing of the shofar, though we're not told that specifically. And then a rather involved process is going to begin. The Lord could have revealed Achan's name to Joshua without all of this process, but by doing it over a period of time, and this would have taken all day, the Israelites have time to think about, to consider the seriousness of what has taken place. Now, I can't imagine how Achan must have felt. This process dictates that for the guilty party, he'll be kept in a state of dread as one by one, all of his neighbors are dismissed and go away to continue living their lives while he awaits his doom to be announced to the people in the camp. This was worse for Achan than the night of the first Vietnam draft lottery. If you don't know what that was, you're fortunate. All right, let's look at the second section here, beginning with verse 16. So Joshua rose early in the morning and brought Israel nearby tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken. Uh-oh. He would have been off the hook if it had been Simeon. It's Judah. He brought the family of Judah together, and he took the family of the Zerahites. He brought the family of the Zerahites together, man by man, and Zabdi was taken. Achan knows. He knows what's going to happen. He brought his household near, man by man, and Achan, son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, was taken from the tribe of Judah. And Joshua said to Achan, "My son, I implore you, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give praise to him, and tell me now what you have done. Do not hide it from me." So Achan answered Joshua, and he said, "Truly I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel, and this is what I did. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar," Shinar is Babylon, "and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold, 50 shekels in weight, then I coveted them," notice, coveted, "and he took them. And behold, they are concealed in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath." So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran to the tent, and behold, it was concealed in his tent, the silver underneath. They took them from inside the tent, brought them to Joshua and to all the sons of Israel, and they poured them out before the Lord. And Joshua said to Israel with him, then Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, silver, the mantle, the gold bar, and his sons and daughters, and his oxen, and his donkeys, and his sheep, and his tent, and all that belonged to him, and they brought them up to the valley of Achor. Achor means trouble. Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." And all Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. And they raised up over him a great heap of stones that stands to this day. And the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor, the Valley of Trouble, to this day. Boy, am I behind. He saw, he desired, he took. Let me just read you something from Genesis 3, because this is the pattern. Genesis chapter 3, verse 6. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband. Some things never change. This is the pattern. He saw, he coveted, desired, and he took. Here's a man who had been part of the wilderness generation. He had to have traveled in the wilderness at least 20 years, probably longer than that. During that time, everything he had ever needed, God had given him. The manna may not have been Chateaubriand, but he never went hungry, and it sustained him. The water he drank, the Lord provided. The clothes he wore didn't wear out. And they provided a covering from the sun and the heat of the day and warmth in the cool of the desert night. Everything he needed for his entire life, God had given him. And then he blessed him even more by bringing him into the promised land, so that at a time when Achan should have been the most grateful, the lust of the eyes overwhelmed him, and he saw a beautiful sport coat from Babylon, because that's what a mantle from Shinar is. One like Chip's got on over there, which I like. Kind of like that. Sport coat from Babylon. He took off his dusty old robe, and he dressed for success. Remember that book, Chip? Then there's the pride of life, the opportunity to become wealthy through the gold and the silver. These things attracted him. He wanted them. There goes the 10th commandment. So he took them. There goes the 8th commandment. The furthest thing from his mind was the truth. Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. We'd do well to take heed of Paul's instruction to Timothy. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. We find out that Israel acted deceptively. Achan acted deceptively. He did this because he had taken the things and then lived as if he had not sinned. When we harbor unconfessed sin and continue to live as though we had not sinned, we're doing exactly what Achan did. We're living deceptively. But there are two people who weren't deceived. Achan wasn't deceived, and God wasn't deceived. I think before we turn to Achan's confession, we should note that God doesn't plunge his sons or daughters into eternal perdition when they sin, if indeed their sins have been covered by the blood of Christ, just like that night in Egypt when the Lord passed over the homes with the blood on the doorposts. Likely what's in view here is not eternal perdition, but divine discipline. It's a discipline of the most severe imaginable, short of the lake of fire. What I'm saying is I just have a sense that Achan was a believer. He's a believer who was tempted. He's a guy who made a horrible decision, and he paid a terrible price. Now, I'm going to skip something. I'm sorry to do it, but there are a couple of things I want to say, which means I got to skip something. If we have a problem with the punishment God exacted against Achan, in fact, if we have a problem with the conquest itself and the violence that we see in Joshua, these things grow out of a deficit in our understanding of the nature of sin. In addition to giving the promised land to Israel and the conquest, God is exacting judgment on the Canaanites for centuries of terrible evil that we can hardly imagine. And God has the right to do that. And furthermore, God has the right to choose the instrument by which to carry out his judgment. And it just so happens Israel was that chosen instrument. I think what ultimately resolves this issue of the violence in Joshua is the understanding that ultimately it is God himself, in the person of Jesus Christ, who took our place on the cross and suffered the consequences, not for his sin, for he had none, but for ours. And when at the time we are able to understand the true nature of sin and then look at Calvary and see that sin laid on the shoulders of an innocent Savior, Achan's punishment and indeed the entire conquest begins to come in focus. And I wish I could have covered some other stuff, but we're out of time.